The cuff was stolen from this case, so the police think, between 11 and 12 o'clock this morning. The theft was discovered by the security men on duty in the building. They came round at 11 o'clock on a regular tour of inspection and the cuff was there, and then they came back at 12 on the next tour and the cuff wasn't. The thieves broke in by forcing the padlock on the main doors at the back of the building. Then they got into this stand over a Hessian shield at the back and took the lock off the back of this case and got away with the cuff.
Hello and welcome to The Sound of Football. I'm your host, Jan Bilton. And I'm joined as ever by Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
And Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And this week we're going to a cold case file. 50 years ago this week, the World Cup went missing. And tonight, listeners, we're going to attempt to find out why, who, when, and what happened on that terrible, terrible day. Graham, you've been doing a bit of investigation, haven't you?
Yes, I have, Jan.
And have you found anything interesting?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, please enlighten us. 50 years ago, you got into your DeLorean, you turned up 50 years ago, and what did you see?
Well, you know, usually we would go in our DeLorean, but this time I had to do some real investigative work. So right. I've been looking around, I've been scouting around in books and on old newspapers, and even some archive footage from ITN and BBC, and been looking around to see if I could find out who actually stole the World Cup, because no one ever got arrested for that.
No one was ever charged.
No one was ever charged for stealing it.
Why don't you fill the listeners in, particularly international listeners who may not be entirely au fait with this part of English law, with the circumstances behind this, and tell us how this whole thing went down, as we pretty much broadly understand it. You know, tell us the story of the World Cup. Give us a brief summation before we go into details about, you know, what happened and how it was recovered.
OK. Well, the World Cup, England were quite late entrants to the World Cup. When it started in 1930, we didn't actually play in any of them until 1950. But when we started going to the World Cup, we thought, well, this is great. We're going to have some of this and we're going to have the World Cup here. And the first opportunity that it arose was 1966. So Sir Stanley Rouse was the head of FIFA at the time, and it was pretty much a nice English affair. It wasn't without its problems. A lot of African nations and Asian nations boycotted it because...
Really?
Yes, they boycotted it because there wasn't a guaranteed qualification place for someone from those conferences.
Right.
So they had to go into a playoff, and it was basically carved up between South America and Europe,
right,
the World Cup at that time. There was only 16 teams in it.
Right.
But it did garner a lot of excitement. Everyone was really, really impassioned and thought, well, this is brilliant. And the World Cup trophy itself arrived on these shores from Brazil, who were the previous winners, in January of 1966, and it was kept under lock and key in Lancaster Gate until the middle of March, when a stamp exhibition in London said it would be great if we had this, the World Cup, as the centrepiece for our exhibition. And it was the theme of the show was football and stamps, because obviously lots of countries around the world gave you a good opportunity to put flags on things.
Yeah,
there's actually a very interesting story, actually, because the post office got into trouble with the government because they produced some special World Cup stamps. And because North Korea had qualified, they put North Korea's flag on there. Unfortunately, the British government didn't recognise North Korea at the time. So it had to get all these stamps taken out. I'm sure if there's any of these stamps out there, they're probably very valuable now, I'm sure.
Yeah. North Korea qualified only by dint of the fact that nobody else from AFC or entered.
Yes.
They didn't, because they boycotted it.
Yeah.
North Korea being North Korea, well, fine, we'll go then.
I think they had a playoff with Australia. I think they were the only team outside of those areas that actually did take part. The World Cup was on display at Central Hall in Westminster, the exhibition opened on the Friday, but on the Sunday it was closed because obviously it's Sunday, and everywhere in Britain was closed on Sunday.
Of course, we were all in church.
Yes, of course. So the exhibition was closed then. Sometime between 11 a.m. and midday, somebody broke into the building and made off with the World Cup.
The rascals.
Where's the also location of the building? It's in Westminster, right?
Yes, it is.
So it's actually just across from the Palace of Westminster, is it not?
It is actually, as you come out of the main entrance of Central Hall, Westminster, you are looking at Westminster Abbey.
Right.
And you've got the Palace of Westminster behind
it. Just yonder. Yeah.
So it is right in the middle there. And in fact, it is perhaps about 300 yards away from Scotland Yard.
I was going to say.
Yeah, and the Home Office looms right over it as well. So
it's right in the seat of power for the British government.
Yes, very, very, very embarrassing to lose something with such high profile, especially 10 days before a general election.
Oh,
yeah.
That's got to hurt, isn't it?
That is got to sting. Red faces all around in Scotland Yard, anyway, who got onto the case straight away. Now, of course, there was a national hunt to find where the World Cup had gone to. This was the age of big heist capers and robberies. It seemed like every other week there would be someone in the news who was holding a train up or stealing a film star's diamond necklace. This is the time of the Pink Panther and things like that.
The Great Train Robbery.
The Italian Job, Great Train Robbery. Yeah. Fiction and fact merged into one. It was very much that sort of time. And this just seemed like another story to go along with that. On the Monday, Joe Mears, who is the chairman of Chelsea and also the head of the FA at the time, gets a phone call from a guy called Jackson, and he says, "I've got the World Cup, and you're going to pay me 15 grand, or this is going into the melting pot."
Just for clarification, the World Cup is made of what? Is it made of gold, as Kenneth Walsingham said it was when England lifted it, or is it not made of gold? Is it made of something else?
It's made of silver.
It's made of silver. So its actual street value would be considerably less than £15,000.
Its street value at the time would have been about £60.
Right. £60.
£60.
60.
Six zero.
Obviously its value politically and just as a thing is
as an object
priceless.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Has no value in
yes.
that respect.
It has what's known as provenance. It is a piece of art as much as anything. And it's actually insured for £30,000.
Right.
Which is interesting because they've gone for £15,000, exactly half of what it's actually insured for. So it is probably within the insurer's interest to pay up rather than it getting melted down and them having to pay the full insured amount. The insurers themselves offer the public £3,000 for information leading to the recovery of the World Cup. There are quite a few other interested parties that join in, also people who want a bit of publicity as well. Gillette offer £500 extra as well to go on there. Jimmy Hill offers £50, and it all goes up.
Wow.
So the pot suddenly builds up.
It all mounts up.
Yeah. It all mounts up. So it becomes suddenly something that if you knew something about it, if you were on the darker edges of society, you might want to be involved in a bit of money like that if you could dob someone in. On the Wednesday, an actual letter arrives, and it's got the cup section of the World Cup. You know what it's like? It's got like the woman standing there with her arms up, holding up the cup.
Yeah.
The inside of that, there's a lining in there that comes out.
Right.
So that was sent with the letter, and the letter reiterated what was said in the phone conversation.
So it's a metaphorical lock of the hair.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So you're like, this is it.
Yeah.
We've got the World Cup. Here's proof. Send us the money. £15,000 by the end of the week. Otherwise, it's going in the pot.
Right.
So they're really squeezing in. And this makes sense because if you're holding on to something like that, you want to get rid of it as quickly as possible.
Whole world is looking for this thing.
Yeah. So you want to get rid of it. So they decide to pay. They decide, right, okay, well, we'll arrange a meet-up, and if you've got the merchandise, we've got the money, we'll go.
They're being the FA?
The FA with the police. Right. They've told the police by now.
Right.
But he's still doing it, and he's not told Jackson, the guy who's making the threats, he's not told him that the police are involved,
because he has actually said, don't get the police involved, don't tell the press. This is all just going on between me and you. And actually, in the press, there is nothing about this. They don't know anything about the letter of the bit of the cup that's been sent out. So they arranged to meet on Friday. Joe Mears is in such a state over the whole theft of the World Cup thing. He actually has a minor heart attack and is actually laid up in bed. It's actually so serious. It's actually an angina attack. So he's actually suffering from heart disease at that time. And actually, he only lives to the end of June. So he only survives another 3 months after that. In his place is Detective Inspector Len Buggy. He's in charge of the investigation, Len Buggy of the Flying Squad. And he is going to be the guy who takes the money and swaps it for the cup. Or arrests the man there and takes the cup and gets everything. You know,
Depending on how it goes down.
Depends how it goes down. He goes to Battersea Park to meet Jackson. There are two other Flying Squad vehicles buzzing around in the area. Jackson says to Buggy, right, let's get in the car and I'll take you to where the cup is. So they come out of the Albert Bridge exit, which is on the west side of Battersea Park, and they drive west. And then they do a right turn and a right turn, and then they're going east towards the Oval. All the time, Jackson is looking in his windows, checking out who's following them, and he notices a van, and he says, that looks like one of the vans that Flying Squad use. So this is a man who's a bit clued up about the way that the police work. Because he's turned all the way around, he can see people who have made two extra turnings as well.
Right, yeah.
So it's easier enough to spot
if he's being
taught.
Yes.
Yeah.
They go around the back streets a bit, trying to lose them. Obviously, Buggy doesn't want to lose them because they're his backup.
Yeah.
And they drive past Kennington Park Road. They make a right into St. Agnes Place, which at the time is just on the back of Kennington Common and is basically slums. Most of the houses there had been abandoned and they were in rack and ruin. So this was a great place to come down if you're Jackson, because no one's coming down that road. Well, no one has any need to be driving down there because it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So he gets out the car there and says, right, stay here. I'm going to go and get the World Cup. You've got the money. He's already checked to see that he's got the money, even though most of the money there is actually newspaper and envelopes.
Right, so it's not money.
It's not money.
Okay.
There's a couple of real envelopes in there, supposedly. And he gets out the car and starts making down towards Royal Road. And as soon as he does, the Flying Squad van pulls out. So Jackson turns on his heels and starts walking the other way. Jackson gets suspicious. He's obviously been suspicious anyway about what's going down, and he makes a run for it.
Yeah.
Buggy goes after him, chases him through the Brandon Estate, jumping over the communal gardens, over fences, and ends up catching him in Lorimer Road. They arrest him, take him back to the Nick. They find out his name's Ted Betchley. He's 47. He's had one previous conviction for handling stolen goods. That was back in the 50s, so about a decade before. And since then, nothing. So they've got him, but they don't have the World Cup. Betchley, he didn't say anything that would implicate anyone else. He didn't tell them where the World Cup is. He lives on Grosvenor Terrace, which is a road that goes on to Camberwell Road.
If I'm getting my geography right, if he lives in Camberwell,
and
this all went down Kennington Way, so he's, what, 10, 15 minutes walk away from where it went down?
Yeah. They search his house and the cup's not there. All he says about it is the fact that he was the middleman. He was offered 500 quid by someone known as the Pole to facilitate the transaction.
And when you say the Pole, are we talking about someone from Poland, or are we talking...
Well, it could be a nickname. It could be like someone very, very tall.
Tall and bit of metal.
He said he was a business contact.
Right.
His business was selling fancy goods to market traders. That's what he gave his job as. So
this is Betchley, right?
Yeah. So basically, he was a dell boy.
Yeah.
He sold stuff. In fact, the local market is East Street Market. Which is actually the market that's used at the start of Only Fools and Horses.
you couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
And we haven't either.
It's actually Ookie Street. Yeah. so that was probably what he did. So he was probably someone who was dealing in...
So do you think he was a stooge, really? I mean, do you think there was any intention to facilitate that? Or
I think, personally, he was a fence.
Right.
He was obviously someone who had his brushes with the law. He's obviously someone who lived on the fringes of lawfulness, and he was probably someone who rid of stolen gear.
He was put up by whoever has this cup to try and facilitate the exchange of cash.
His excuse was the fact that he was in debt. He had a CCJ against him.
Right.
Now, back in those days, CCJs weren't that common. It wasn't like nowadays where everyone's got personal credit, that you didn't normally have personal loans like that. So it was probably a business loan that went wrong, or something maybe a little more nefarious. He kept quiet. He didn't mention any names, but he said about this poll, he said, well, it was a business contact, and he said, look, you can earn £500, get yourself out of a hole, and we'll take the rest of the money, thanks. When it came to trial, the judge thought that was a load of hooey, but they had nothing to link him with the theft.
Right.
So they could only charge him for handling. That's how it went down. He was sent down for 6 months.
So how was the World Cup recovered? Because we all know that they did lift the World Cup.
Yes.
Not long afterwards.
Well, luckily, on the Sunday night, 9 o'clock Sunday night, David Corbett goes out to make a telephone call to the telephone box across the road on Beulah Hill, and he takes his dog with him. As he's leaving his driveway, he notices a package underneath the bush right outside his house. He picks it up. He's a bit wary of it because there's been bombs and things in London recently. Mm. He unwraps it, and the first thing he sees is a little plaque that says Brazil 1962 on it. And he unwraps it fully, and he can see he's got the World Cup.
Mm. And this is the story of Pickles, the famous
story of the dog Pickles was with the dog. Him. Yeah. Yeah, the dog was
the dog
with
him. And the legend is that it was the dog that actually found the cup.
Corbett said at the time, and has said subsequently, that's not how it went down. No, but the thing is that it made great copy.
Yeah. And everyone was just probably so relieved that it was back.
Yes.
That they said, oh, look, and there's a dog there.
And there's a dog.
Let's make it about the dog. Yeah. And then hopefully everyone will just forget about the fact that it was stolen in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, which also plays well into the overarching thing, was the fact that it was the week leading up to an election.
Yeah.
And having the cup being stolen, that's bad news.
Yes.
But having it found by a dog.
A cute little dog called Pickles.
Yes. And
that's going to make you feel good.
That's going to make you feel good and make you feel that, maybe the people in power at the moment aren't so bad after all. Let's vote them in with 100 majority.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened.
So the timescale is when was that recovered then?
That was on the Sunday night, so 1 week.
So just 1 week. So
just
the whole
1 week.
This whole thing went missing for 1 week, and it was recovered by a chap and his dog.
Yes.
After a botched attempt to ransom it.
Yes. That's the story about it. But no one was ever fingered for the theft. No one else was ever implicated in the theft.
Hmm.
Just this guy Betchley.
Just this guy Betchley. This guy Betchley, who was set up to be the fall guy.
Yeah.
And he took the fall. But
interestingly enough, I mean, for all we know, Betchley could have fabricated the entire thing himself.
He could have.
Because he was never seen with the World Cup.
No.
He never knew where it was, never revealed where it was.
No.
There's no evidence linking him, no prints on it.
There's no prints on the cup, no prints on the paper, nothing to say.
So we only really have his word and the fact that he wasn't prepared to, fess up perhaps and say, look, I'm making the whole thing up, I'm just a fantasist.
Yeah.
So one assumes that he was being controlled by other parties.
Yeah.
And those other parties never made themselves clearer and were never discovered.
He obviously had hold of the cup at some point because he got hold of the lid.
But did he send the lid?
He knows all the details about the letter, and obviously they met up with him.
So he was obviously the guy they were in contact with
because there was no publicity about the contact between them. So he must have had something to do with it.
He must have had some involvement.
And actually he admitted the fact that
so, but someone's put him out. He's not a criminal mastermind, is he?
Well,
someone's put him up to this caper.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was seen, but at the time that he was working with someone else, it must have been planned.
Yeah,
It can't have been a just a spur of the moment thing.
No, not an opportunistic theft.
No,
there must have been some security.
It's not a smash and grab.
Yeah, I mean the security. I mean there were stories often about how you know perhaps security guards could have been a little bit more diligent in their duties. But in fairness, the place was locked up, and
yeah, you
know. Well, it wasn't locked up on the Sunday. This is what makes it so well planned, and the fact that it probably did have insider knowledge because on the Sunday. A portion of the building was open because there's a Methodist chapel in there, and there was 200 people moving in and out around 11 right, to 12. Okay. So there were people coming in and out and going through the building to use the toilets.
Right.
So there is a lot of people in there, and there's not only the cup that's in there, there's also £3 million worth of stamps that are in there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So the security are spread about, looking about for everything. They're one man short as well, but they're not the most diligent of security guys. They're all part-timers. This is their weekend work. Mm. And sometime, if you are going to steal the World Cup, this is the best time to do it.
Yes.
When, in broad daylight, but also at the time when there's no one actually in the room with it, but there are people in the building to cause a distraction.
Mm. So who do you think put them up to this? Because I mean, we require a fairly significant a number of people, I think, to pull the caper off, not to actually to do the act, but the whole infrastructure around it. You know, what to do with it afterwards.
Well, the network involved in there would mean that you would be looking at someone perhaps involved in organised crime.
Mm.
That's probably the most logical conclusion you can come up with. Given Bletchley came from Camberwell, there was only one firm operating in that area, and that was the Richardson Gang. And their headquarters were on the other side of the road from Grosvenor Terrace, around Addington Square. Now, the Richardsons were bigger than the Crays at this time. They had more power, and certainly in South London, they dominated the dodgy dealings that were going on around at the time. If something had gone down of this size in Camberwell, if it was this was where the World Cup was being started, and they didn't know about it, it would be very dangerous for the people who were dealing with it, because they wouldn't only have the police to deal with, they'd also probably have the someone say, hang on, we want a slice of this cake.
Right, so it'd be the understanding being that there's something going on, it's happening on their manor, to use these old-fashioned phrases. And that a piece of the action is required. But of course, it's possible that they had a direct hand or indirect hand in the caper itself.
The only fly in that ointment is that at that very time, there was a gang war going on across London. Because 2 weeks before the World Cup was stolen, Eddie Richardson and Frankie Fraser and a couple of their cohorts were drinking in a nightclub in Catford called De Smith's. And they'd been invited there by the manager, Mr. McLeish, and the owners, who were up in Manchester, to say, right, OK, we'll have your fruit machines and you will look after the place for us. You'll make sure it's secure, because we're getting a bit of pressure from rival gangs. Unfortunately, those rival gangs were there that night and there was a gunfight.
Oh. Right.
Ended in the death of Dickie Hart, who was aligned with the Crays. And it ended up with Frankie Fraser having a bullet lodged in his femur. And it ended up with all the members of the Richardson gang that were there were arrested.
Mm.
Then within 48 hours, George Cornell, one of the Richardson gang's enforcers and someone who lives in Camberwell as well, is shot in The Blind Beggar by Ronnie Cray. So everything is all collapsing around there.
Right.
Charlie Richardson himself, who wasn't involved in that shootout and is the only one really of the hierarchy of the gang that isn't actually in prison or in hospital at the time or dead, has got troubles of his own, because he is living in fear that he's going to be extradited to South Africa because he ordered the murder of a business associate of his.
In South Africa.
South Africa. He got a man called John Bradbury to go and drive a hitman to his house and shoot this guy called Waldeck. And Bradbury got arrested, and he was basically told that you'll be found guilty and you'll face the death penalty. Well, he goes on trial in April, and it is known that he's going to basically dob Charlie Richardson in and all the goings-on of what the Richardson gang do. And if that happens, then Charlie Richardson could be extradited to South Africa. Now, Charlie Richardson has written about this in his books. Charlie Richardson died a couple of years ago. And what he says happened was that he was approached by South African intelligence to carry out certain actions against anti-apartheid groups in London. He says that he organised raids against the anti-apartheid movement, the Zimbabwean opposition party, ZAPU, and also Amnesty International. He gets a group of house raiders, or breakers, burglars, what have you, to go in there, steal important documents, and give them to South African intelligence.
And presumably, in return for these deeds...
In return to these deeds,
he won't get extradited
and
won't go to South Africa and won't be executed. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the story about how that works. The way he paints it is the fact that he's being led astray by this beautiful femme fatale, Jean Lagrange. It all adds a bit element of spy to the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, chucking caper movies and now spy movies.
Well, I mean, let's face it. I mean, like, if the only thing that was more popular than gangsters in the middle of the 60s was spies. This whole thing sort of comes out even more. So you've got these breakings are happening in March.
Hmm.
There's actually two breakings on the same weekend in London that the World Cup is stolen. It doesn't take that much of a leap to imagine that maybe the same crew was involved in that.
Right.
If Richardson was involved in it somehow, with most of his gang in prison, money would have been something that he might have needed quite quickly, and £15,000 could solve a lot of problems for him.
Yeah. Or do you think maybe he might have seen it as an opportunity? If he'd known that it was there, and while he was in the area, or his people were in the area doing these deeds, because I mean it's all quite close by. So it's all in the same kind of area.
Yeah.
That maybe they might say, well, actually, do you know what? While we're here, we may as well nab that.
Yeah.
Since it's going to be there, this would be a good opportunity just to like a side job more than anything else.
It's either the fact that he has organised it. It could even be, if you want to get really conspiracy theoried about it, it could be the South African government has said, actually, we'd like you to steal that for us, please.
Well, it's a Labour government, isn't it?
It's a Labour government. Harold Wilson is not very, very popular at all.
Ill-disposed towards the apartheid movement. So, I mean, I suppose it's not beyond, politically, it's not beyond the realms, but it seems quite fanciful. You're saying, if you're ordering a number of capers that are, genuinely speaking, designed to undermine the enemies of the South African government, then stealing the World Cup's not going to be a bad thing from their point of view.
No. It's a bit more, it's more gangster than spy, this thing.
Yeah.
It's certainly something that I would think that it would be more of the case of someone say, I need money fast.
Yeah.
And this looks like a good way of making money.
Richardson never says anything about the World Cup theft in his book.
Never. But then again, old gangsters don't say anything that will put them in a bad light.
Yeah.
There is an interesting story that he does mention in it. It's nothing to do with the World Cup, but there was an actor called John Bindon who was a dodgy geezer. And a friend of his. And he got mixed up with Princess Margaret, had an affair with her, apparently.
Mm.
And he had some pictures of him and Princess Margaret in compromising situations.
Yeah.
Supposedly. This is all in his biography.
Yeah.
And he had these, and he was holding them to ransom, basically. He was saying, I've got these photos. Unless I get paid £100,000 by the royal family, then I'm going to go to the press with these pictures. Bear with me here. Charlie Richardson steps in and says, John, you're never going to get away with that. But £5,000, jobs are good, and how's that? So he comes across as being the hero here.
Yeah.
He's actually being the go-between here. And it's Richard Harris who is the go-between between the royal family and Charlie Richardson.
Richard Harris, the actor.
Richard Harris.
Richard Harris, the actor. Yeah, I've told you, it gets a bit weird. So this is all in the book, so you can read up about it. And Richard Harris is the guy who gets hold of the envelope with the photos and doesn't even open it and just chucks it on the fire and it all burns up.
Does he really?
Yeah.
He doesn't even have a little peek?
No. See. And neither does Charlie Richardson. Because
they're gents, aren't they?
They are gents.
Right. Gentlemen,
please. See, that's how they like to perform themselves. Not the fact they're all involved in some kind of extortion racket.
Yeah.
It's all embellished up to be okay. Gents here.
It would have been contrary to his image, his own sort of self-image if he had sort of like fessed up to being
Charlie Richardson doesn't confess to a hell of a lot of things he did.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, especially while you're alive and you start confessing to crimes, you're liable to become
especially prison. Unpopular ones when they're things like extortion. No one's going to admit to it. So, but the fact is that this happened on his doorstep, and for him to have no knowledge of it.
It seems
bizarre. It does seem very bizarre the fact that he wasn't aware of this going on, especially if he stole it to melt it down for gold and then discovered it wasn't made of gold.
It wasn't gold, But I mean, you have to be really. I mean, was it how common knowledge was it that it was made of gold? I know because it was
printed in everything that it was made of solid gold.
Right.
Really?
But in fact, it wasn't at all.
No. No, the Times on the day after it was stolen.
It does indeed. They say it's made of solid gold. Yeah,
£9 of solid gold, and it wasn't. It was silver. £9 of silver.
Yeah,
it could have been just for financial stake like that, and then all of a sudden, well, it's not gold anyway, so may as well hold it up for ransom.
The intriguing element of the story is that there's all this stuff going on around, you know, all these other break-ins going on involving Amnesty and the ANC, the anti apartheid movement, and all of that going on, and it just brings in these extra dimensions of geopolitics into it.
Well, the whole thing about organised crime was almost linked with it anyway.
Yeah,
the police were in turmoil anyways throughout the mid-60s. This has come 2 years after the inquiry into Harry Challoner. Harry Challoner was quite an unfortunate individual. He was an ex-member of the SAS who suffered from schizophrenia and had violent tendencies, and also happened to be a detective sergeant in Flying Squad.
Right.
And unfortunately, he
abused his authority.
He was hearing voices in his head to dispense justice the way he thought fit.
Right.
And he got into a lot of trouble, basically. He ended up accusing people of things that they never did. And lots of people got pardoned on cases that he was involved with.
Right.
And it brought to light the problems of Flying Squad and the fact that a lot of them were on the take. And this was something that got worse before it got better.
Mm.
Even when Challoner was taken out of them and put into a hospital and looked after, there were bent people in Flying Squad. And so the reputation of it was on the floor.
But so you've got a melting pot here of the police very much on the back foot. You've got the gangs on the back foot involved in the massive war.
Yeah.
And then you've got Richardson, who is involved in something to get himself out of trouble with the South Africans.
Yeah.
Perhaps open the door for an opportunistic thief to come in, an independent to come in and do an independent caper.
Yeah.
Nick the World Cup and make off with it.
Yeah.
Because everybody else is too busy with their own.
Well,
business.
It certainly is. There certainly could have been a power vacuum there with all the members of the gang, as I say, like either arrested or in hospital.
An experienced art nap, perhaps.
Yes, it's an interesting term, isn't it? Art napping. This was a new crime, and it fits what the whole theft of the World Cup was perfectly. Art napping started in the south of France in the early 1960s in Saint-Tropez. Basically, someone cleared out a restaurant that was full of these 20th century masters and held them to ransom. And they got a load of money for it, and the owners got their paintings back. They were stolen by the Corsican Mafia, who were operating in Marseille.
Right.
And they repeated these crimes because they thought, well, this is great. This is a perfect crime, because what happens is they steal the artwork. The insurers will offer something that is about 20% of the actual value.
Worth their while.
Yeah.
Mm.
Something like a consideration for them.
Mm.
They will pay them up. They will give the paintings back. Everything works. Everyone's happy.
Mm.
Now, the police don't get someone to throw into chokey, but
no.
Yeah. Sometimes they will. Sometimes they'll be at someone's house and there'll be some unfortunate patsy who's left holding the pictures.
Yeah.
This hadn't really happened that much in London. There'd been one previous episode in 1962 at the Jacques O'Hara Gallery in Mayfair. And they went through there and they stole £500,000 worth of paintings.
Wow.
And that was
a big job though, isn't it?
That was a big job, especially this is 1962 prices. This is tens of millions now.
Yeah.
They went out exactly how that pattern emerged. They stole them, they sent the ransom demand, The insurers offered them something.
And they paid up.
They paid up, and then the paintings suddenly came back again. But it wasn't done again afterwards. And the World Cup theft was the first time it publicly came out. It could have happened that there were other thefts, and they said, look, don't tell the press.
Keep it under your hat. Yeah.
Don't tell the press, don't tell the police.
Mm.
And the insurers will be quite happy enough to go along with that because they want the paintings back.
It's bad for business for them.
It's bad for business. It's bad for business for anyone.
It's all bad for everyone looks crap out of it. So it's possible that, So we could be looking at an example of this sort of burgeoning strand of crime. Perhaps, just taking advantage of organised crime in South London in the period of transition, to use football parlance.
Charlie Richardson is actually arrested on World Cup final day.
Oh, right.
On the morning by the police. Obviously.
Well, I don't know, by the South Africans.
No, he is actually arrested for the crimes that he's committed in this country.
Right.
So much information comes out at the trial of Bradbury. The guy who shot the guy in South Africa.
So they suddenly
it all comes out in court in April, and London police send over two detectives to go and talk to Bradbury, and also to try and sort of say, look, he's talking to us. Can you commute that death sentence for him, please?
So Bradbury sings like a canary.
Bradbury sings like a canary. Well, he sung like a canary at the trial. Right. So, and he knew, he can never go back to London. So, but these detectives come back, and with other evidence that they're getting. This is also another thing about how bad Flying Squad is, because Charlie Richardson has people in the police force. So he has connections in the police force to distract people from him.
That, it doesn't surprise me at all.
It's the chief constable of Hertfordshire Police that does the investigation into Richardson. So it's people that are outside of London who actually
arrest him. Because of his influence.
Yeah, because of the influence he has. And so he is arrested actually on World Cup final day, coincidentally, or maybe not. Maybe they knew something. Maybe they thought, well the cup's going to be out again today. Maybe he's going to have another go for it. But art napping, it's got all the hallmarks of it.
Mm.
In fact, there is another incident of art napping that happens in 1966, that the similarities of the World Cup theft and this one at Dulwich Gallery are so... they're almost identical in some respects. On New Year's Eve, 1966, early hours, someone breaks into Dulwich Gallery and makes off with 8 old masters, worth then about £1.5 million. So could be £100 million in modern money.
Yeah.
If they were to go on sale now. Same thing again. A day later, there's a telephone call to say, give us £100,000 or these go on the fire. The only problem is these pictures aren't insured, so there's no insurer there
so there's no one to
pay up. And there's only the trustees of Dulwich Gallery, and all they can get is £1,000.
Yes,
they probably did a cake baking sale.
But luckily, someone does have a sniff at that and goes, yeah, all right, I'll have that. And a guy called Thornton phones up and says, go to a flat in West Kensington and you'll find your pictures. And so they go to this flat, they find 2 blokes there with 3 pictures, and they say, well, we don't know where these come from. Someone came round and dropped them off.
Right.
But it's in the press that they've recovered 3 of the pictures. But they don't give any details about how they got there or who they've taken or what they've done with the people who are there. A couple of days later, a package wrapped up in newspaper and string is found under a bush.
By a dog?
By a dog.
Really?
By a man with a dog.
By a man with a dog.
I was only joking.
No way.
In a part of Streatham Common called the Rookery. Now, Streatham Common is actually, that part is about 15 minutes walk from where the World Cup was found.
Right.
So
clearly, South London was the place to return stolen goods.
Yes. Mm.
If you were a criminal with a conscience and you thought, you know, this is not the life for me, it's about time I found a, you know, go and get a job in Woolies.
Yeah, but as with the World Cup as well, no one was fingered for the theft of that. Someone like Betchley was arrested for handling it, but no one was done for theft. But I reckon whoever was responsible for the theft at Dulwich was responsible for the World Cup theft.
So, naming no names, and on that bombshell, I think it's probably about time that we wrap that one up in newspaper and hide it under a bush
for a dog
to find it.
So this week's sample will not be dropped in the usual way. You might have to work a little bit harder to find it. Sorry about that.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our departure from the usual subject matter. I think a round of applause for Grim.
I think so.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent bit of journalism there, Grim. But, well, we hope you enjoyed that. And until next week.
Our 250th episode.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah. So you thought this one was special. Well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like the foreplay, isn't it? Before the big events.
We're not going to be able to make this.
Well.
It'll just be us reading the paper. The sound of us reading the paper.
I think we deserve it then. Maybe we can talk about some football next week.
No. You think so?
We should do that.
Shall we?
No. From me, Ian Bilton, from Terry DeFellin, and from Jim Sibley, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
It's 9:29, election night, 1966. We in this studio are waiting now to bring you the result of the votes that have been cast throughout the day. But now, before we begin, the very, very first result of the night. Have we got it ready?
No, not quite.
The very first result of the night is just coming in on a piece of tape. We're loading it into this very special machine, which will bring to you and to us the results as fast as they possibly can brought you. And there is the first result of the night. Hull City 1, Chelsea 3.